So nice to have you back, Gilbert, on this podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Let's get started with the current phase of the policy of NATO right now. They're talking about shooting Russian missiles. And do you think at the end of the day they would do that? Because we've seen the same type of manner on their part when it comes to the tanks, to fighter jets, cluster bombs, and each and everything. They denied to do that. Then they went after that plan and sent all of these weapons to Ukraine. Do you think is NATO getting to the point that they're going to shoot Russian missiles? And if so, what would be the consequences of such an attitude on the part of NATO?
Well, this proposal was made by the Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski. And to my knowledge, it was dismissed by Jens Stoltenberg. And the consensus, at least as reported, in the Financial Times, is that this does not have the backing of NATO. The NATO member states are now deeply divided about whether they want to fight a war with Russia, whether they want to risk a war with Russia, whether they believe in Russia's red lines, or whether they like to accept Mr. Zelensky's idea that the red lines count for nothing and just go for it, boys. So it is difficult to predict exactly how each country will line up, but they need to have 100% consensus. And there's nothing like that at the present stage. So such a move, which would be highly provocative, I think would not presently pass a vote in NATO.
Yeah. How do you find right now? We've learned that the Ministry of Economy of Ukraine is asking for 800 million, if I'm not mistaken, US dollar to just reconstruct their infrastructure of energy. And with the same type of manner that they're having, do you think the United States is going to just continue sending more weapons, more money to Ukraine? Because it has to be some sort of limit for this type of attitude on the part of Ukrainians, but it doesn't seem that they feel it right now. But on the other hand, we have the reality of the political parties in the United States and how do they feel about the conflict in Ukraine. How do you see, do you think at the end of the day, the Zelensky administration is still hoping that they're going to get more help from the United States in the future?
I'm very doubtful if there will be a Zelensky administration in the next few weeks. I follow the newspapers, not just in Russia, but in the West very closely. And one of my leading papers that I follow is the Financial Times, also the New York Times. And there's been a sea change in the coverage of the Ukraine war ever since the start of the invasion, well, first a raid and then invasion of Kursk Oblast. And what do I mean by a sea change? In the preceding period, going back before the first week of August, what you saw was a general discounting of any possibilities of Russia advancing. We only see them move a few yards a day in there on the main line of confrontation or demarcation between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian forces in Donbass. There was disparagement of Russia's war-making capabilities and encouragement to the Ukrainians. What we have seen since the start of this very unfortunate invasion, of course, unfortunate for the Ukrainian military forces, is very open coverage in major mainstream media of the nature of the disaster. I mean, they are explaining what the Ukrainians did wrong by doing this, how they counted mistakenly that the Russians would divert resources from the Donbas front to the Kursk front, and how as a result, the Russians have been escalating day by day the number of kilometers, not inches, not meters, but square kilometers of Ukrainian territory, going as much as, and this is the Russian news was saying this past Sunday, gaining as much as 30 kilometers a day after having considered a good piece of business to gain a few meters a day before August 7th, or whatever the date was, of the start of the invasion. This is all covered precisely in Western media. Now, why are they doing that? Are they doing that because suddenly they've got religion? Suddenly they decided the truth counts? Nothing of the sort. They are preparing the way for the removal of Zelensky. This whole catastrophe is going to be pinned on his chest. And I would suspect either we will find him in a month on a plane to Miami, or we'll find him in a coffin on the way to the cemetery. But the possibility that this man will stay in power after the devastating news reporting on him in mainstream, I'm not talking about ourselves, about the alternative media, but in mainstream. This cannot go on that way. So whatever his ministers are doing or asking for, maybe they need a few hundred million to cover some real estate transactions that they personally are engaged in at this moment, feathering their nest before the end. But I don't believe that anyone in the West is going to put up that kind of money. Germany is the weather vane on this matter. And coming out of Germany, even before the devastating elections in Thuringia and Saxony this past weekend, even before Mr. Scholz was slapped on the face by the electorate and his future as leader has been put in jeopardy, even before all that, he was making sounds because of the insistence of his finance minister that there isn't any money in the kitty. So making sounds that the Germans would be winding down all manner of assistance to Ukraine. Therefore, all the speculation that may go on in the States or elsewhere, that this aid will go on indefinitely, that we will help the Ukrainians to the end, it's turning out to be a very bitter end, and it's in front of our eyes. At the same time, I want to take a step back from what many of my colleagues are saying on air in very widely viewed YouTube interviews. I do not for a minute believe that the conquest of Donbas, which is imminent, that by conquest I mean going straight to the Dnieper, it won't happen next 2 days, it won't happen the next week. Even a crumbling front line in Ukraine has some resistance to it. And the Russians particularly are very careful not to expend their own lives of their own soldiers just to rush what they otherwise will have a little bit later. So I imagine that next month we will see that the Ukrainians lose the Donbas. But my colleagues are speaking of this as if they've lost the war and as if Ukraine will disappear from the map or some sort of great change in human history is going to occur. I don't subscribe to that. And I'm not the only one who does, who feels this way. I had a very interesting exchange with a voice in these matters that many of your audience will know, and that's Paul Craig Roberts. And we both are complete agreement that the war won't end with conquest of Donbas up to the Dnieper. The Russians, there are a number of reasons for this. The Russians don't want to move beyond the Dnieper. It would be extremely difficult. The bridges aren't there. And crossing the Dnieper, it was a major logistical challenge. But that's the least of the reasons. The real reason is they don't want to move into what is Ukrainian territory. Because this takes us back to the whole story of the Donbas in 2014. There are those who say, oh, yes, the Russians could have taken Donbas in 2014. The Ukrainian army wasn't worth anything. I agree completely. In terms of military capabilities, the same Russian army that took Crimea without firing a shot, or maybe one shot, could have taken the whole of Donbas away from Ukraine with very little loss of life on the Russian side or even on the Ukrainian side. The Ukrainians just would have raised a white flag because they were totally unprepared for a military conflict with Russia in 2014. However, in 2014, Russia would have been brought to its knees by United States sanctions, and it knew that perfectly. And so they would have had a Pyrrhic victory. They would have conquered the territory and lost the war. Therefore, they did not take Donbas in 2014. To the There's another reason. They knew they were not sure that they would win a vote in these oblasts if a vote ever were taken for joining Russia. In 2014, it was really debatable. Looking at 2024, like it's obvious, hands down, 2023, these territories had lost substantial Ukrainian population, fled. And those Russian speakers who were left, many of them warmly welcomed the incoming Russian troops. So the victory at election at the electoral box of the Russian cause in the Donbass oblasts was in 2023, 2024, barely a certainty. Formerly in 2014, it was by no means a certainty. These are complex issues, and they have to be faced with a certain sophistication and not with the kind of cackling that we see on the face of the presidential nominee, Harris. Unfortunately, too many of my colleagues are also cackling, and it's not appropriate. The Russians have spent enormous amount of blood and as well as treasure to get where they are, and they are very prudent about any further expenditures of both blood and treasure to gain more, particularly when gaining more means taking possession of territory which will forever be hostile to them. They don't want it.
If we were to draw the Russian objectives right now, do you think that their objectives are mostly political right now or militarily?
I think they have been political from the beginning. The nature of the political motives were never fully disclosed to the Russian nation because they are realpolitik considerations. And realpolitik does not go down well with ordinary people. Mothers don't send their sons to die or their husbands to die for the sake of realpolitik. They may do that for the sake of national self-preservation. So the arguments that were made to the Russian people were always in this cliche, in this notes of national preservation. The Kursk misadventure of Zelensky was partly such a misadventure because he failed to appreciate what being invaded meant to the Russian nation. The information from the Russian Ministry of Defense over the past weekend has shown that the level of daily sign-ups for kontraktniki, for the voluntary entry into the Russian army to fight in the war in Ukraine, has jumped by 50% since the start of the invasion of Kursk. It was, before the start of August, 1,100 per day. It is now 1,700 per day. That tells you the story about the upsurge in patriotism and national self-defense. It's one thing to carry out a military operation on somebody else's territory. That, again, does not warm hearts anywhere. But to defend your own country when it is invaded, that is a different story. And both the Ukrainians and the American backers for this insane invasion failed to appreciate that difference. I'd like to switch to something a little lighter than these facts and go back to literature and the literature of War and Peace of Tolstoy. The war didn't end. Napoleon's war on Russia didn't end in 1812. The Napoleonic Wars weren't over until 1815. But once the Tsarist forces, and with the help of of partisans, of the citizens in arms, peasants mainly, expelled the invading forces of Napoleon beyond the borders of frontiers of Russia. Frankly, the Russian people lost interest in these wars. They became something similar to the old dynastic wars. The liberation of Russian territory in 1812 was a national cause. And when that national cause was realized successfully, well, the war ended for the Russians, for the Russian people, not for the Russian armies, but for the Russian people. And so it is today this is again a nation-making event. The Ukrainian or NATO invasion of Kursk is a nation-building event for Russia.
How did you find this jets crash, F-16, in the Russian media? Are they talking about it? Because there are some rumors that it was a Russian jet that hit this F-16.
They are very interested in that question of who did it. And I'll give you a reason. The Russian military, the president announced when it was clear that F-16s were coming to Ukraine, that the first jet shot down, those who did it would be awarded 15 million rubles, about 15,000 euros. How did Russian media cover the shoot down or the destruction of that plane? They said, well, what are we going to do? Are we supposed to give the 15 million to the Americans who are operating that Patriot system or to the Ukrainian military commander in the field when it went down? That's the level of seriousness. It's not really serious for the Russians. They don't believe they had anything to do with it. The question is, how it could be that that there was such friendly fire that brought down the plane. And what I've heard on Russian television is that the responsibility lies with the failure of the Americans to ensure that there were on board that plane the responders, the devices that NATO planes carry into a war zone to ensure that they are not shot down by friend, that they are identified on a friend or foe test that precedes any missile firing. Apparently that was not the case here. And so the blame would lie with the Americans who did not provide the equipment necessary to ensure the safety of that plane. The Russians are saying, again, what I heard on Russian television is that this was undoubtedly a Patriot which brought down the plane because of the nature by which the Patriot missile explodes. It explodes over the plane, and it makes the catapulting, which normally would save the pilot, impossible. Therefore, the unique nature of this accident what proved to Russian onlookers that it was a Patriot, and the reason for the delay of 3-4 days before revealing the loss of the plane was probably the Ukrainian top command and Mr. Zelensky's team trying to figure out how to get around the fact that the American Patriot had shut down an American plane, which happened to have Ukraine's top pilot.
Yeah. Here is an article, and it was published today. And they're talking about that Ukraine is winning, still can win this conflict. The problem, it seems to me, that when it comes to the mindset of the European Union together with the United States, as we call it, NATO, it seems in their view, the situation on the battlefield is totally different from what we're witnessing right now and from what Russians are perceiving from the battlefield. And do you think that we are witnessing a battle between two type of rhetorics that they don't want to understand each other? Or because this type of mutual understanding is so important for the future of any sort of political settlement, it doesn't seem that we are getting to the point that we are having any sort of understanding between these two parts, which are totally ideologically, militarily, when it comes to their strategy on the battlefield, when it comes to their ideology, what's going on, the reason behind this conflict, it doesn't seem that they do understand each other's rhetoric.
Well, I think that the looking at the quotations in that article, what they were saying, the people who were being interviewed are delusional. The possibilities of educating them, I think, are nil. And I say they don't have to read us. They don't have to listen to Nima's program. They all have to do is pick up the Financial Times to see that everything that they were saying to the journalists at that meeting was complete rubbish. The question is, then how will things get better? Well, I think we saw that in the elections in Germany this past Sunday. The legacy parties got slammed. There's another election coming next week just on the east of Berlin, and most likely the same results can be expected. Both France and Germany are in serious political trouble, and in both in Germany, those who are making trouble for Scholz's cabinet are definitely calling for an end to the war, and/or they're calling for an immediate end to German support for the war. In France, the travails of Macron are more diverse, and you can't relate them to the Ukraine war. But the fact that his government is now only a caretaker government, and that it is unlikely that anytime soon he will be able to form a proper government, means that France is very weak politically. And so if Germany succumbs to democracy and starts to listen to the people and their votes in what was in East Germany, two states, two Länder, the highest turnout they've had since the reunification of Germany. If this happens, and I think there's reason to believe it will, when Mr. Scholz has been caught out, I think that that Europe will collapse. That is, the leaders, or the followers, or the servile followers of Washington, who now are the head of the major governments in Europe, they will go. And I think the EU institutions, headed by von der Leyen, will be drained of their power by forces like the one that Orban has been organizing in the European Parliament. So I think this is the way. It will be a change, not because the chaps who were quoted in that article will see the light and will understand that they are delusional. I don't think that's likely. But they will be replaced, and not from a distant future.
Yeah, the problem with this type of mindset, that if we think that they're not believing in what they're saying, but they're just pursuing some sort of other objectives, like weakening the Russian economy, like isolating Putin, like all of these objectives, which is in their mind is the outcome, would be the outcome of this conflict in Ukraine. They're not achieving any of these objectives. The Russian one, we have no sign that the Russian economy is going weaker. And we have no sign that Putin isolated. And he was in Mongolia, and we've heard that the Ukrainian government is asking the government in Mongolia to arrest Putin. It's unbelievable the level of ignorance right now.
Yeah, the level of political stupidity also. I think Mongolia's state wouldn't exist for about 10 years if anyone there were so foolish as to try to arrest Mr. Putin. But that's neither here nor there. But I think there's been no coverage of Putin's visit to Mongolia, other than to show what you now have up on the screen, the splendid reception that he received when he arrived, and the issue of the International Criminal Court. These are the two things that have been said in major media in the West about his visit to Mongolia. But they have not said nothing about the content of the visit. And the content of the visit may be quite interesting. They may make some progress on logistical solutions for Russian gas to China by way of Mongolia, the so-called Power of Siberia 2. That may be will be under discussion, but other joint projects will be surely the subject of Mr. Putin and his delegation's talks with the Mongolian leadership. The Mongolia is very carefully maintaining a balance between East and West. Its policy lines, as the Russian Orientalists have explained on their own television in the past 2 days, that Mongolia is acting very much like India, trying to walk this narrow line, not to give offense to either the United States or to the Russians, to maintain its independence and its own sovereignty. So nonetheless, the fact is that Russia supplies one third of all the hydrocarbons, fuels that Mongolia imports, that Russia is a major trade partner. And yet, of course, Mongolia has not joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Mongolia has kept a certain distance from what could look like alliances. But they have been very useful. They also, the Western media, have said absolutely nothing about the timing of the visit. Yes, we know that he stopped in Mongolia on his way to Vladivostok to participate in the Eastern International Economic Forum that is now going to get underway. But the timing of this, he arrived on the 2nd of September, which is the anniversary day of the end of World War II, that is to say, the unconditional surrender of Japan. And Mongolia was very helpful to the Russian Red Army in their fight against the Japanese in the closing months of closing year of World War II. So they are celebrating their role as comrade in arms, so to speak. Although Mongolia did not fight directly in the war, it did provide substantial assistance to the Russians, who did fight in the war against Japan.
The other thing that we've learned, that Putin invited Erdogan for BRICS, and Erdogan accepted the invitation. And on the other hand, we have the other thing that has happened in Turkey is this sense of they're against the Americans, the presence of Americans in Turkey because of this conflict in the Middle East. It seems to me that here comes the question when it comes to Turkey, that we know how important Turkey is within NATO and how their army is important, and politically and militarily they're important. What's in the mind of Putin right now when he goes after this plan of inviting Erdogan? It seems to me that Russia and China is trying to drag Turkey into BRICS, and that would be hugely consequential for the United States.
Well, I think the Russians have no illusions about Turkey, about Mr. Erdogan in particular, that he is not an enemy and he's not a friend. Mr. Erdogan looks after Turkey's interests as best he understands them, and he has been very useful, very helpful to Russia during the course of his whole conflict with Ukraine. But nonetheless, he has shown very little courage in a number of areas that could have been very helpful to the Russians. I mean, for example, the way Turkish banks all folded, collapsed, and obeyed American instructions to break ties with their Russian counterparts and to make life rather difficult for Russia, where the Americans were heavily invested and were making strongest demands. Nonetheless, Turkey has cooperated fully in energy matters, and both in nuclear and in hydrocarbons, and Turkey remains the Turkish stream, an important bridge between Russian pipeline gas and certain countries in Europe, in Western Europe. So all of this is true, Mr. I think the most interesting changes have been with respect to Syria, where Turkey was one of the biggest enemies of the regime in Damascus, and gave a lot of support to the Syrians' enemies among the radical Islamists. At the same time, Turkey found itself very aggrieved by American support for the Kurds in Syria, and its refusal to recognize the Kurds as terrorists, which the Turks maintain. So there's been a very narrow balance here between this love hate between Turkey and the United States, and a disposition towards the Russians, but which has been very helpful, but not full commitment. There are things, I say, that the Turks could have done, which they refused to do, and by making concessions to American demands. How this will play out, or whether Turkey will actually join BRICS, if so long as Turkey is a NATO member, it is hard to see that these are reconcilable. The American position in the Middle East has put the Turks in a very difficult position. After all, Mr. Erdogan is entirely aligned with Hamas. They are the same blood brothers in terms of religious charitable work and religious civil society. They are blood brothers. The United States is helping Israel to destroy the Palestinian people and Hamas. That is unacceptable to the Turks. Despite all the talk about how wonderful NATO has rallied thanks to the Ukrainian war and its consolidation, its ever greater strength, there is really the possibility of Turkey dropping out. And as you say, Turkey has the second largest army in NATO after the United States. The loss of Turkey to NATO would be very consequential and in no way could be compensated for by the tiny accretive benefits for security that Sweden and Finland gave to NATO. So these issues are very important. I agree with you entirely.
Getting back to the situation in Ukraine, it seems to me that this Kursk incursion was a very important moment in the Russian strategy toward the conflict in Ukraine. Do you feel that Russia is drawing a line for their strategy before this incursion and after this incursion?
I think we have to watch this very closely and not draw premature conclusions. A week ago, Mr. Putin said no agreements, no negotiations with the Ukrainians under any conditions because of their invasion of Kursk. Now wait, yesterday Mr. Putin was saying, well, actually we can talk. And I think there are reasons for that change. He is following daily, maybe hourly, what's going on in Ukraine. And what's going on, I say, is the likelihood that Mr. Zelensky will be swept out of power very, very soon. That the United States and the allies will pin on his chest its disaster, military disaster in Kursk. And so, the Russians want to be ready to negotiate with somebody. So Putin yesterday very clearly stepped back from the categorical refusal to deal with Ukrainians. The Russians are playing this in a very cagey manner.
Yeah. And do you feel right now that the European Union is getting prepared for that? Or they're not just in that kind of mindset to consider it?
Well, I think their rather weak minds are wholly concentrated on what happens if Trump comes to power. And everything else is kind of secondary. So I'm not sure how much attention they're devoting to these issues. They really are following the United States here. The United States is not giving very clear signals. Will it do what Zelensky has been begging for? Will they allow him to use his ATACMS and his Storm Shadow and the Scalp missiles to strike at the heartland of Russia? I don't know. That really depends on whether Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Blinken and whoever is minding Mr. Biden are beginning to appreciate that that is risking a lot more. If they paid attention to Mr. Lavrov's statements about 10 days ago, which were perfectly clear that America's playing with matches and will get his fingers burned, I was putting it kindly, then they will understand that they should not escalate and that there are red lines with the Russians. They're definitely defend.
Because right now we've learned that Germany is telling Ukrainians that all of the weapons that they're sending to Ukraine, they can use it the way they want it to use. It seemed, which means they can hit deep in the Russians' territory, which is, we haven't seen this before on the part of Germans.
Well, the Germans are not sending their long-range missiles. That has to be said. So if you're speaking about artillery and shells, okay, but that's not going to hit Moscow. The Germans have been were standing around dancing from foot to foot. They never shipped any of those missiles. But this was a year ago, the Ukrainians were begging for. So what the Germans have done, which really got under the skin of the Russians, was to send the Leopards and allow the Leopards to operate in Kursk. That revives too many foul memories on the Russian side of, here we are again, the Nazis are back, and they're back in their own tanks. Well, that has been a disastrous mistake by the Germans, not only because those tanks got shot to pieces, blown up almost upon arrival in Kursk, but because they even dared to try them. That was crossing a kind of red line that isn't obvious to outsiders, but to the average Russian was perfectly clear. They have memories of the Kursk battles, and they certainly have memories of the Germans on their territory and what they did then, and what they hear that the Ukra-Nazis, as they call them, the troops of Mr. Zelensky, particularly the Polish mercenaries, have been doing to civilians that they've come across in Kursk Oblast. All of these are very bad memories. But it's not what you're talking about. It's not long-range missiles that can do damage to the Russian heartland.
Yeah. Do you think that the latest changes in Germany, political changes, would influence their policy in Ukraine? I'm talking about the rise of AfD, the alternative for Germany, or Deutschland.
Well, I would look the other way. I would look at Sarah Wagenknecht. The cordon sanitaire, the exclusion of the AfD from any coalition government, which the legacy parties seem to maintain, it means that the only people they can deal with to form a majority in these Länder parliaments is Sarah Wagenknecht. And she is from the Linke originally. She has a lot of the socialist mindset and policies. And she is the most open person with for ending the war in Ukraine, ending all German support for the war in Ukraine. That is going to be a tough one for any of the legacy parties to accept. But if they want to have a workable government of each of these vendor, they'll have to accept it.
Yeah. And just to wrap up this session, do you think that right after this Kursk incursion, Russians were talking about that without the United States, the Zelensky administration didn't have the power to do this, because they have been provided with intelligence, with the military mercenaries, all of this. But on the other hand, we're hearing that maybe London is behind this. The mastermind of this incursion was London. And right now, do you feel that they're going to put the blame on Ukrainians, or London going to take responsibility, or even the United States? If you were to mention the mastermind of this incursion, which it seems that ultimately is hugely damaging, is not in the benefit of the Ukrainian army at the end of the day.
In the days immediately following the entry of Ukrainian forces into Kursk, Russian media was saying that London had designed this attack, and that London was behind it. And Mr. Starmer was the Prime Minister of England, was very accommodating. He went public boasting about how the Challenger 2 tanks from Britain were now on Russian soil fighting for the Ukrainian cause. So if he wanted to paint a target on London, he couldn't have done a better job. Nonetheless, in the days since, I see a migration away from the vilification of the United Kingdom for this adventure in Kursk to direct finger pointing at the United States. I mean, I'm talking about the Russians pointing the finger. And this falls into line with what I just said a few minutes ago from Mr. Lavrov's latest position statements, that if they were directed to the United States and they were saying that you guys are not going to get off scot-free, your notions don't have any value to you in protecting you from us, and we're going to come after you. Therefore, in this new latest Kremlin line, I think the Brits have been pushed back a little bit. Maybe they'll be hit second. But the Russians want to make it clear that they will not allow the Americans to generate an intra-European war that would be devastating for Europe when America gets to go to emerge from this conflict without any harm or damage. The Russians are saying, we will damage you first.
And when you look at the level of relationship between London and Russia, do you understand why London is so radical when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine? Because we've seen this attitude on the part of Polish government. Right now, it seems that London is much more radical than the government in Poland. Is that something historical in their mind, or it's something new?
Well, there was a Crimean War, after all, in the middle of the 19th century. The competition between London, when London was the empire of the world, and the Russian Empire, which was a substantial empire, but a land empire, and the Britons had a sea empire. That is to say, their colonies were all abroad and reachable by sea. The Russians had an empire that was under their noses. It was just extended land. But these two empires met in Central Asia, and in their ambitions for Afghanistan, and also Russian ambitions on India in the middle of the 19th century. And of course, Russia had its ambitions in the Dardanelles in its hope to take possession of Istanbul, which was anathema to the British and to the French, and was what was behind the Crimean War. Of course, you can trace this back in history, the rivalry of these competing colonial and then imperial powers. from the 16th century on, 17th century on. But I think it's more reasonable to take it back no further than the Crimean War to see what were the rivalries and the mutual dislike of certain strata of English society and certain strata of Russian society. Having said that, there also always was a substantial group of Anglophiles in high Russian society in the 19th century. So the things are never clean breaks, white and black. There are always some kind of shades of gray. And that pertains also to my answer to your question.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gilbert, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Well, I'm very appreciative of your allowing these sometimes unconventional views to reach your audience.
Yeah. Okay.